I want to use it somehow.
Such an odd.
It's just like.
Well, welcome everyone. I'm Sam Bardwell. I'm coming from Minnesota. This is my second week of teaching. Last week we also talked about Shakespeare and how we might approach Shakespeare as an actor, taking clues embedded in the text as a kind of instruction manual from Shakespeare, since we know he was an actor and had a great practical knowledge of the theater and not just as a writer of really beautiful words, but as somebody who had a great sense for drama and intimate knowledge of his own company, so people with whom he worked really regularly. And any folks coming in today? Any new folks in the village today? Yay. Well, welcome. And some of the things, this is actually, it's the last session from this first week. We'll be starting some different sessions in the coming week. But so far this week, people who have been here, any memories of what we've talked about in terms of the, it's a dangerous question to ask, but in terms of how we approach Shakespeare, does anybody have any memory of Martha?
Well, one day we looked at a couple of Hamlet monologues and talked about the challenge of dramatizing thought and embodying thought. And we paraphrased one of them, and that was a really fun, exciting experiment, creative. And then we also looked at another approach, different from paraphrasing, which was more sort of paring it down to the essential theses of the argument, and then reincorporating the language back in and realizing how vital each word is. So it was fun to have those approaches.
Yeah, we had a really... The village voice was particularly vibrant in the paraphrase of how all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. I had no idea how many things that speech said until this village paraphrased it last week. But yeah, ways of embodying this language, the word made flesh, if you will, how we can take these somewhat intellectual seeming arguments and thoughts and make them really visceral and real and playable, ultimately, for the actor. So today, in particular, I want to look at a character called Margaret, who is appears in some of the first plays Shakespeare ever wrote. When he first arrived in London, he wrote three of the first plays that we believe he wrote are Henry VI, Part 1, and its sequel, Henry VI, Part 2, and then the follow-up, Henry VI, Part 3, and then the spin-off, Richard III. So if you can imagine, it's a bit like the Wolverine franchise of the X-Men, you know, that it was so popular that he picked this character, Richard III. And also Margaret, incidentally, has the longest arc of any character, in living character in the canon. That she appears in the first part of Henry VI, Part 1, and plays very prominently in the next two plays, and also comes back in Richard III, in what is usually a kind of... By the time she appears in Richard III, she's often kind of conceived as a real loony. She's a prophetess, essentially. She comes in and she rains down curses on people, because by then, things have gone really sour for her. But it's unfortunate, usually, because it's very hard for us to appreciate the full richness of her arc if we only ever see her in Richard III. Has anybody here seen Richard III, by the way? Do you remember the character of Margaret from that production?
It was a long time ago.
Long time ago. What do you remember anything from that production?
The production was in London.
Hmm.
I remember Richard. You know, he's like 50% of the lines in the play, right? more.
Yeah, so. Oh yeah. Yeah, he's a substantial hunk of text.
So sorry.
And he walks funny, and that helps remember him too. He's also.
Did you any
remember either
vision of?
Been too long.
Yeah.
Craig, did you you've been in Richard III?
Yeah, I've done it twice actually. Weirdly, I played the Duchess of York, the other old lady, both times.
Not for its time.
Yeah.
Strange.
The Duchess of York. Yes. So there, so there are a couple of scenes, or there's that one at least big scene between the women, right?
Sure, yeah.
And was there a, in that process, did you have any really, was Margaret a focus of your kind of actor talk and director, you know, sort of table work or conceptually or just practically?
Yeah, it was a little bit because Margaret has so much earlier material, mm-hmm. even, you know, in the Henry VI plays right there. But when you see her in Richard III, she's an old lady, of course. She's like a crazy sort of possessed kind of woman who just like seems like, why is she just like in her first big court scene? She's sort of like around the edges, muttering and giving these curses and stuff like that.
And there are a lot of them are asides.
A lot
audience.
Of them are huge, long asides too, where she's just like spitting tacks about Richard because she hates him so much.
And these would be things that the other actors weren't supposed to hear, but that the audience gets to hear.
Okay. And then she comes back a couple times in the last one with the Duchess of York and Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. She's there, and it's more of a. Almost a mourning scene for the other two women, but for her, she's continuing to just sort of rage, and then she. I'm trying to remember what happens to her storyline then at the end of.
She goes back to France.
She goes back to France, yeah. In the movie version, Maggie Smith, yeah, she gets on the airplane and goes away.
Yeah, that's right. Has anybody seen any, heard of any of the films of Richard III? There's a Olivier one.
Is that the Pacino one, too?
Pacino did a Richard III thing, right. I actually haven't. Looking for Richard, right. I haven't seen that.
It's good, but I don't remember the details.
Yeah, I don't remember what role Margaret plays in it. But this, what Craig described, I think, is pretty accurate. She comes in and she's, you know, in our culture, we don't have much room for prophets, let alone prophetesses. You know, that's not really something today that we can comfortably allow. You know, it's certainly dramatic. You know, it certainly has an appeal from a dramatic standpoint of this woman who is well-skilled in cursing. You know, there's certainly... But it does sort of do the character a disservice because she seems... Martha, you saw a production of Richard III. Do you remember Margaret from that production?
Yeah, I've seen it a couple times, but I don't...
She did this gesture.
Oh, did she? Yeah, I don't have really a vivid picture of what she was like.
But, you know, this is a, so it's interesting to note that in Shakespeare's day, they were extremely superstitious, but also, you know, Christian. And so it was an interesting dynamic. Physiognomy was really huge, and especially in a play like Richard, especially in a narrative that includes someone like Richard III, who is, at least according to Shakespeare's characterization, is crippled in a lot of ways, or is deformed in several ways. Many of the characters, including Margaret, comment on how this is connected to his moral character as well, is corrupted. But just to give a little background about Margaret, in that she first appears at the end of Henry VI, Part One, and she's a prisoner of war. So she begins being captured by a nobleman named Suffolk. The Earl of Suffolk, and he describes her at that point as being fairest beauty, nature's miracle. He says about her, as plays the sun upon the glassy streams, twinkling another counterfeited beam, so seems this gorgeous beauty to mine eyes. Her, and then later when he's describing her to, what happens is he basically captures this prisoner, looks at her for the first time and instantly falls in love with her. It's almost like a Shakespeare play. But So there's that, and what he decides is, you know, I can't. What can I do? And he determines that he's going to try and convince the king to marry her, and then he will still have an affair with her. Is his plan? Is what that he hatches in this little scene. It's a really fun scene to play because basically he's aside-ing to the audience. And she's aside-ing to the audience, going, "Why won't he talk to me? What's his deal?" And then later, once he brings her back to England and is trying to explain to the nobles and the king's peers that she's a worthwhile match for the king, he says, "Her peerless feature, joined with her birth, approves her fit for none but for a king. Her valiant courage and undaunted spirit." So there are these kind of descriptions of her very early on as courageous and beautiful. And we talked a little bit in earlier sessions too about, in Shakespeare's language, sarcasm didn't play as strong of a part. I think, has anybody seen... what Shakespeare plays have folks seen recently, actually? Has anybody seen Shakespeare recently?
As You Like It.
As You Like It. That's a great one. And do you remember Jaques, what they did with Jaques? He was the All the World's a Stage guy. The tone of his... It's often a somewhat of a litmus test for what people are, what tack they're taking on the play.
Yeah. They use sarcasm more than it might be evident in the text. But.
Well, and I think he's, of course, once I say that sarcasm isn't all that important, there are certainly characters like Jaques that really do rely on a lot of that. But for the most part, in Shakespeare, it's very helpful at least to explore that what people say is true. Unless they tell you, "I'm gonna totally trick this guy in the next scene," or "that scene that just happened, that was totally fake," then we can basically assume that what they're saying has a great kernel of truth. So these are things that have been said about her. "Bethink thee on her virtues that surmount, and natural graces that extinguish art." Then at some point, she, as Craig said, by the end of Richard III, she's a hateful, withered hag, and a foul, wrinkled witch, prophetess, and a false, boding woman. She's well skilled in curses, a she-wolf of France. So there are all these, and also interesting to explore how playable those images are. Yeah?
Who was she in France?
Speaking of her background, so her father was the king of Jerusalem, and, the king of Naples. Oh, actually, the king of Naples, Sicily, and Jerusalem, which when you say it, you can't help but think, wow, king's a good thing to be. But it's actually a very hard thing to play in the plays because it's actually worthless. It's of almost no value. And so when this Suffolk character I mentioned convinces the king, who's very young and impressionable, to marry this woman, it's sort of disastrous in the minds of every one of the English nobles. But it's very difficult to play, because whenever you bring up the word king, our mind usually goes to, oh, that's what kings do, is they marry the daughters of other kings. But her father is the... And another bit of description of her is, you know, she-wolf of France, but worse than wolves of France, whose tongue more poisons than the adder's tooth. How ill-beseeming is it in thy sex to triumph like an Amazonian trull, which is a sort of another image of this kind of wild woman. And she's also Margaret. Her husband, Henry VI, just wants to be a shepherd, which is a kind of wonderful juxtaposition with the other big success in London at the time, which was Marlowe's play, Tamburlaine, which was about a Persian shepherd who becomes an emperor. So wonderful that we see. So Shakespeare sees this great success, this kind of barnstorming performance by this actor playing Tamburlaine, who was, you know, all over the news. He was the leading man in that company, and so he writes this play about Henry VI, who is this king who wants to be a shepherd, and his wife ends up essentially becoming the commander-in-chief. So the way I look at Queen Margaret, who does end up marrying Henry VI, moves from prisoner of war to commander-in-chief to hateful withered hag that's been banished from the kingdom. So I'd love to pass around some speeches and read through them and see if we can get a sense of some of Margaret's text, and some if we can sort of feel out, speak out her art, if you will. And it's interesting to note, does anybody know how Shakespeare's casting practices were for women in the Elizabethan theater? Exactly. Can you expound on that at all about what that?
Well, acting was highly suspect as a career. Because
still is by most parents.
Of course.
But.
Yeah, actors. You can trust them. Yes. So there were no women on the Elizabethan stage. Boys played the roles.
Yes.
Well, there's no women allowed.
Right.
Okay. Or
so it could have been. I mean, yeah.
Right.
Especially meaning there may have been some.
Some clandestine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Hard not to make that speculation once you've seen Shakespeare in Love in particular. But yeah, of what we know, it was illegal for women to act at this point. So boys were trained as apprentices in the company, and they were taken on very early. And it's a kind of incredible to imagine, at least for me, how we could have taken them seriously in any kind of dramatic context. Cleopatra has a great line. So it would have been a 12-year-old boy playing Cleopatra, and she says, you know, one day they will parade me through the streets, and some, you know, squeaking actor will boy my greatness, you know. Mm. And it's, so there are a lot of rich levels there. But so Margaret would have been another character that would have been played by a boy, and then when Margaret becomes the warrior, it's kind of a boy playing a woman, playing essentially acting like a male warrior, because there also weren't a lot of, but we did have Queen Elizabeth, so there were some pretty tough broads out there to model yourself after. But this first scene is this first monologue is a kind of a wonderful, or well, awful and wonderful piece of when Queen Margaret's on top. What's happened is she has captured there's a civil war going on in England. Her husband, Henry VI, is still king, but the York family is trying to take over. And so she has captured York, finally. She's got him right in his hands. And recently she's Clifford, one of the soldiers who has sided with her in the War of the Roses, has killed, not only killed his son, but dipped a napkin in his blood. And this is a small child, and kept this napkin, which will play prominently in this. In this monologue, and that's one prop. And then there's another paper crown, which which is another prop. I was wondering, Craig, have you read through this? Do you have any desire? I don't want to put you on the spot at all if you're not feeling at all. Since
to read the first one here.
Yeah, if here.
Sure. Yes, I can read.
Thanks.
As a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, as a 12-year-old boy, as a woman.
Playing. Brave warriors, Clifford and Northumberland, come, make him stand upon this molehill here that wrought at mountains with outstretched arms, yet parted but the shadow with his hand. What? Was it you that would be England's king? Was it you that reveled in our parliament and made a preachment of your high descent? Where are your mess of sons to back you now, the wanton Edward, the lusty George? And where's that valiant, crooked-backed prodigy, Dickie, your boy, that with his grumbling voice was wont to cheer his dad in mutinies? Or, with the rest, where is your darling Rutland? Look, York, I stained this napkin with the blood that valiant Clifford, with his rapier's point, made issue from the bosom of the boy. And if thine eyes can water for his death, I give thee this to dry thy cheeks withal. Alas, poor York. But that I hate thee deadly, I should lament thy miserable state. I prithee grieve to make me merry, York. What, hath thy fiery heart so parched thine entrails that not a tear can fall for Rutland's death? Why art thou patient, man? Thou shouldst be mad, and I, to make thee mad, do mock thee thus. Stamp, rave, and fret, that I may sing and dance. Thou wouldst be feed, I see, to make me sport. York cannot speak unless he wear a crown. A crown for York. And lords, bow low to him. Hold you his hands, whilst I do set it on. Aye, marry, sir. Now looks he like a king. Aye, this is he that took King Henry's chair. And this is he was his adopted heir. But how is it that great Plantagenet is crowned so soon and broke his solemn oath? As I bethink me, you should not be king till our King Henry had shook hands with death. And will you pale your head in Henry's glory and rob his temples of the diadem now in his life against your holy oath? Oh, 'tis a fault too unpardonable. Off with the crown, and with the crown his head. And whilst we breathe, take time to do him dead.
Wow. Thanks, Craig. That was great. Wow.
What did I say?
Does anybody have any questions about the kind of the context? About who this, do you have a sense at all of what kind of lady this is? Or what she's capable of, at least? What I'm trying to get at is this doesn't completely define her, but this is a kind of speech women don't usually get in plays, or even often in Shakespeare plays. I mean, women are often more articulate than the men, and making great arguments, and often really compelling ones against war, but this is a vicious thing. And often what happens with what Craig was reading about, and if thine eyes can water for his death, I give thee this to dry thy cheeks withal. Alas, poor York, but that I hate thee deadly, I should lament thy miserable state. I prithee grieve to make me merry, York. What? Hath thy fiery heart so parched thine entrails that not a tear can fall for Rutland's death? Why art thou patient, man? Thou shouldst be mad. And I, to make thee mad, do mock thee thus. Thus is often a clue in Shakespeare that there's some kind of action, connected with it. And so it's one of these internal clues we were talking about when Hamlet says, speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of our players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my words. Nor do not saw the air too much thus. that's often, you know, taken as a cue for some sort of gesture. So what I've seen played before here is she's holding this napkin, and it won't make him cry, and he's restrained. And I've seen it where she shoves it in his mouth, which is a sort of, like, you know, terrible, you know, terrible thing to do. But it gives the actor a little license there to come, you know, how can I torment this man most? And
well, she's trying to humiliate him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And threaten him, or hoping to have others threaten him.
Exactly.
Inciting others to threaten him.
Yeah, there are people around. It's really important that there
are
Clifford, there are non-speakers in this scene who are on her side. That's a great threaten. And do any other actions? This is something that for actors is really vital. If you can call out the, as Hamlet says, suit the action to the word to the action. For us, that means we need to kind of marry the text with some kind of intention, which is informed by the text. Does anybody, I think that's, was it threatened, did you say?
Threatened, humiliated.
Humiliate is a,
Incite in others.
Get, any other actions that people sensed out of the hearing it spoken aloud?
But, you know, after putting the crown on his head, Mary said, now he looks like a king. I mean, so here's a, she's going to gesture to him, maybe she's going to bow or kneel and encourage others to do that. Here's
Physical.
You know, to me, seeing that scene, it's like, well, this is all, I mean, there's deep cultural parallels here. It's like, you know, the mocking of Jesus right before the crucifixion, a mocking. And the crowning means he's going to be killed. And that's exactly what happens to him.
Yeah, absolutely true. Think these, and we can't deny these parallels. Martha, my wife is in seminary, and I'll do a show, you know, work on a production of Much Ado About Nothing, and people, you know, actors will be in it, and the theater is not a place where people talk about God. That's not really something that goes on. It's not a very popular subject. In the contemporary theater, but it's in some ways it's a great shame because there's a theological richness to all of these plays. I would argue, and those are really important connections to draw. I think, kind of Christological. I mean, that was the culture. Yeah, and I love what you say about what that, you know, these actions, they come from the words, and then suddenly they're indicating, oh, how do we deport ourselves on stage, you know? How can you mock someone with your body? How can you, as one of the silent observers, which is such a terrible way to describe, you know, what you should be doing? I mean, how can you be active? And I think that involves a physical life of responding to these words, which are, did anybody have any kind of, and thank you so much, Craig, for reading that coldly. That's
okay.
That's a terrible thing to ask someone to do. I won't do it again. But it really worked.
Now I've read through the other speech.
But there is a kind of immediacy that I did want to share. That of, we know that these plays, you know, were, you know, at one point they were new and the actors didn't necessarily get to hear them all the time, so... And other actors wouldn't have known what the length of the full speech was. The next actor only would have received from all of what Craig read. They would have had the last three words, "Do him dead," before they knew their line was coming. So in some ways, this was always new language, because they didn't get to sit in a rehearsal for 6 weeks to learn it. So picking up these clues on the fly, exactly like that, and saying, "How does that indicate my posture?" Or I think is a really great insight. And that crown is such a great, you know, a paper crown. Any other thoughts about the emergence of a kind of character out of this? Do you have an image of somebody when you hear these words? How do you? Do you seem?
I think her whole King speech is very sarcastic.
Yeah, you know, actually, I was going to say, yeah.
I mean, you can just feel it.
I think
It's really great to establish a rule like I just did foolishly, because that means that you know you will break it, and you will break it heinously, or not heinously, usefully.
How old a woman is Queen Margaret when this speech is given?
It's a great question, because we know she starts ostensibly as a, you know, not that nature's miracle can't be any age, but we sort of get the impression that she's this young, marriageable woman, you know, that a guy would ostensibly say, oh, let me marry her off to the young King Henry. So we think she's a young woman, and it's a delight to think about Shakespeare's, you know, sense of time and place, because he really, in some ways, you get the idea that he just didn't care on some levels, and then other times he can be very, very particular, and it can be useful to think. A teacher gave us this great exercise about it. Has anybody ever seen King Lear?
Yes.
You remember the character Kent? He's the kind of noble guy that stands up to Lear at the beginning and says, what you're doing with your daughter is foolish. You've got to stop this. And Lear says, stand not between the dragon and his wrath. But he stands between the dragon and his wrath.
Yes.
And he gets exiled. And he, shortly thereafter, puts himself into disguise and follows the king anyway. Kind of one of those...
He's very loyal.
He's the kind of ultimate loyal dude in the king's camp. And there's a scene between him and a character named Oswald, who works for one of the sisters, but is kind of a go-between. Is often, do you know which sister he works for?
Goneril.
So he works particularly for Goneril, but he's kind of moving between them a lot to deliver messages. And there's the scene where it's usually played, it's between Kent and Oswald, and Oswald comes in and he's a little saucy. You get the sense that he's... boy, he may even be a little sarcastic. Anyway, he's just being a little rude, but of course Kent's dressed like a commoner because he's in disguise, and if Oswald knew it was Kent, he'd never do this, but it's not as though you should act this way, even if you don't know who the person is. But it's usually played that Oswald is just some saucy guy, and Kent, you know, then beats him, and because that's what you do to saucy lackeys, and then he gets put in the stocks, and you always side with Kent because you go, yeah! That guy was, you know, but if you think about it, if you look at the clues that Shakespeare left you, supposedly Oswald was riding on his horse all night to get to this other castle. And so if you kind of take that into consideration, we all might be a little saucy and not want to deal with some, you know, guy who's
dressed as a beggar
and acting really presumptuous.
Yeah.
So sometimes these details are really helpful, and with Margaret, you know, it's one of these plays that people like to do, you know, kind of go all sorts of places with, because this is in the middle of marriageable and withered hag. What does the language suggest to you?
Well, the language, I mean, this does not suggest a 23-year-old woman.
It doesn't to me.
No.
I,
you know, maybe not at the other end of the spectrum, but someone who's had enough life and experience that you can give this guy tongue lashing and incite others to take his head off.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
27, maybe.
Which is his age.
Right, which is my age. Great age to say things like, off with the crown and with the crown his head.
Yeah.
But so you get a sense of, oh, well, there is a sense of maturation here. Does anybody else sort of, does that resonate with anyone else, that she seems to be? And to give you a little more background information, so the end of Henry VI, part one, this guy decides he's going to get the king to marry her, and they'll have this illicit affair. Well, it works out great for him, and the king does decide to marry her, and they do end up having this affair, which is found out, and he is killed. So she has also this arc of losing her great love, and it's really, it's interesting dramaturgically, because it's the first reference I know to this kind of theme Shakespeare has of banishment and death, comparing banishment and death that Romeo does in Romeo and Juliet. Probably most, does anybody remember that speech when he's with the friar? And he's saying, the friar says, you know, that thou art banished. And he says, banished? This, you know, be merciful, say death. You know, that they, you know, there's this. But that first appears in Henry VI Part II between Margaret and Suffolk, her love. So what's any more thoughts people had about what this woman? Do you have an image of a person when you hear this yet, or does your Martha?
Well, I just noticed too, like for York, he's not responding.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of mocking that. Like she says, "Why art thou patient, man?" And then later she says, "York cannot speak unless he wear a crown mm-hmm. for York." And so there's something that's indicating something about York's silence. Like he might be even gagged or something. She's
mm-hmm.
mocking his silence, or he might just be so ashamed that he can't retort. Or you know, there just seem to be clues in her text about.
Mm-hmm.
About his silence being.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, that's a great point, Martha. No, the tension is a beautiful point, because I think so often in Shakespeare what happens is someone speaks and we wait and then we speak, you know, and it's sort of people take turns speaking, as opposed to that point I was bringing up earlier about the three word cue line. I think we'll come back to this a few times, but it's so vital to know that those actors only knew the last three words, so they had to be listening to everything they said. And you need to make those choices, certainly. York, I mean, and the other thing about acting that's, important to remember is that you're only as regal as your fellow actors believe you are. You know, and there's a great story of an actress who played Yocasta in Oedipus Rex, you know, the queen, and she walked on the stage. And she sort of walked out like this, and the director said, "Stop, stop, stop! You know, you look like you're a drag queen or something. You know, don't show me how regal you are." And of course, it was a shaming moment for that actress. But the director was wise enough to the next day have her come out without telling her that once she got out stage and stopped, everyone in the chorus went and took this step back and sort of breathed her into authority, you know, this kind of, and of course, you know, if you're actor playing York, if the whole time you're saying all this, he's going, you know, meh, whatever. You know, there are certain cues, a language you need to develop to make this have the highest impact. But the next one is The Tables Have Turned Now, and she does kill York. York is killed, but York has three sons, and now they have killed her son. His name is Edward, and called Ned here, which is the sort of a common nickname for Edward. But so in front of her, they've killed her son, and now she's captive, and she's now gone from being the taunter to the essentially the taunted and the bereaved, from the bereaver to the bereaved. And she says, "Oh, Ned, sweet Ned, speak to thy mother, boy. Canst thou not speak? Oh, traitors, murderers, they that stabbed Caesar shed no blood at all, did not offend, nor were not worthy blame. If this foul deed were by to equal it, he was a man, this in respect a child, and men ne'er spend their fury on a child. What's worse than murderer that I may name it? No, my heart will burst, and if I speak, and I will speak, that so my heart may burst. Butchers and villains, bloody cannibals, how sweet a plant have you untimely cropped. You have no children, butchers. If you had, the thought of them would have stirred up remorse. But if you ever chance to have a child, look in his youth to have him so cut off. As death men, you have rid this sweet young prince." So, kind of a remarkable, parallel between this last speech. Does anybody, or what were people's responses now hearing her voicing these? Do you get does it seem hypocritical that she would say that after waving a bloody napkin? Yeah?
Yeah, it definitely does, considering she was like, oh, hey, my guy killed your son. Here, have a napkin with its blood on it. I'm going to wave it in your face now. So it's definitely like, I'm not exactly sympathetic towards him.
Mm-hmm.
I am. And she acts like this is completely just out. She thinks it's insane.
Yeah.
And she was perfectly fine to do it to someone else.
Mm-hmm. What were you saying, Jamie? Thank you for that. I think that's a very...
I am sympathetic. In both cases.
Oh, great.
I just think she's this very strong character. She's strong as a queen. She's using language, perhaps, in her first speech of men around her.
Mm-hmm.
But then here she is a mother.
That's so true. Yeah.
And her strength comes barreling through that speech.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you... I think that's such a... That, I think that... In some ways, captures the genius of Shakespeare, that he can create a character that well wrought. That I think part of what I want to pose today is that a character like this, that seems to not be cohesive throughout this play, that seems to be at odds with itself in a matter of scenes. I mean, this is just within one play. We've been talking about the scope of four plays, but that actually we are really mutable in our feelings and in our thoughts, and that on a dime, in some ways, though it's absolutely true, it's hypocritical language. In some ways, there's a, and that's what's also so I think wonderful about Shakespeare. That does anybody, who would you suspect Shakespeare sides with at this point? Do you have any feelings about who it seems Shakespeare might think is right or the most wronged, the most right or the most wronged, either way?
Well, this is definitely stronger language. I think this is meant to have us really be outraged at this mother who's lost her son.
And how perfect that we were pushed to the limits of not liking her. I mean, she couldn't have done much of a crueler thing to York. And yet, somehow, we're holding this tension between, wait, you know, aww. And in some ways, we're petrified against that. You know, we want it to be easy. You know, I want to have a villain. I want to have a morality play where there's vice, you know, and there's virtue. And vice, this is the tradition out of which Shakespeare wrote, you know, these old morality plays where there was vice and he was bad. And we knew that from the beginning. And he came out and he told us how bad he was.
Well, there's that tension, because the stronger you villainize someone, whether you're reading about it or you experience that in your own life, when they come to the point of deep humanity, you either have to stay strictly on the side of I'm not listening to you, or you are drawn into her, you are feeling her humanity here in a deeper way because of what she revealed about herself.
Mm-hmm. Because she was able to,
Well, she asked the question also, what's worse than a murderer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's men who would kill a child. Mm-hmm. Butchered.
Mm-hmm.
This speech has so much more emotion, and the other one was, her authority was seeming more almost thoroughly derived through reason and logic. And as a mother, to kind of pigeonhole her into that emotional thing kind of goes with the times, I guess.
Oh, you mean that this is a bit of a bit, oh, that you may see it as, oh, yes, this is, I don't know.
From our century, you can see it that way.
Interesting.
But, I mean, York sitting there voiceless is no emotion. I mean, he could have been expressing his kind of emotions.
Right. And so everybody knows there is, if you want to read another remarkable speech, York does eventually respond to that speech, but you know he does not interject. And I think we have to believe there's a reason that she needs to say those things to him, and then he doesn't speak. And he does have another speech in which he calls her the she-wolf of France. And oh,
tiger's heart wrapped in a woman's hide. You know, this is, and actually, on that, on what you said, I think that's a great point, and I want to share, you know, this notion of our idea, what did you said, the mother,
role,
yeah, it's like a type, and what he says, talks about, O tiger's heart wrapped in a woman's hide, how couldst thou drain the lifeblood of the child to bid the father wipe his eyes withal, and yet be seen to bear a woman's face? Women are soft, mild, pitiful, and flexible. Thou, stern, injured, flinty, rough, remorseless. And so there is then again that idea of like, this is how, at the same time we have these ready-made ideas of what women are. But again, some of that language parallels hers, I think.
She-wolf is a good metaphor, image of who, what she is, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about how protective she is of her child, but and to the point of not really paying attention, well, being vicious against another child, but not her own.
That's a great point. That, you know, I think people generally take it as a kind of insult always.
No, but I think.
But actually, yeah, I mean, for what she wants to be as a warrior, and even some of that Amazonian language, I mean, might not even necessarily be so derogatory. That's this is an empowered woman.
Is her Frenchness an automatic cue for the audience that she is the other, and we're, you know, to me as the people of Shakespeare, that's the end.
It's a great point.
She's from across the channel. Where we, you know.
That's a really important thing to remember, is that she's coming.
Don't do those things.
She's coming from. So she's a double marginalized. She's a woman in a man's culture. She's a French woman in an English culture. So she's. So
I think that's part of why we sympathize, why we follow her, and why we care about her grief. I think Shakespeare's so good at capturing, I think in some ways he writes for the marginalized in a lot of ways, you know, characters that no one else is willing to give, not even, I'm not talking a sympathetic voice, a true voice, a human voice. Characters like Shylock. When Marlowe wrote a play about a Jew, it was called The Jew of Malta, and the guy's name was Barabbas. And he was meant to be a totally homicidal cliche of what people imagined Jews were like, because they didn't know in London.
Did you say she was also a captive?
She had been, yeah. And so she got out of... Yeah, there we go. She had been a prisoner of war. That's another.
In some way she's a slave.
Yeah, and that will always be part of her. So she's constantly working against... Yeah, that's a incredibly important thing to remember about where she's coming from. And why I'm sharing these is, these are the speeches we would never get to hear when we encounter Margaret, because if we see a history play, which is unfortunately not all that common in the, you know, in the Shakespeare world, we tend to rely on the comedies and the big tragedies, especially when money's tight. People want to, you know, produce the one, Hamlet or but even more so Twelfth Night and Much Ado About Nothing, and great plays. But I think there are some voices, and especially female voices, that are really, really exciting. So these are coming from the Henry VI's, and then the last one we have is an encounter actually with Richard. So
this is in Richard III.
Mm-hmm. This is out of Richard III, yes. And Queen Margaret has been. This was Craig was speaking about this scene. Do you want to remind us again? Would you go over the what you had said before about?
So this is a big, early in the third. This is a big court scene that's happening, and Margaret grieving and aged, out of power, is sort of hanging around the palace, just sort of circling around this whole group of courtiers who are sort of battling mm-hmm. away for positions of power. And then she inserts herself into that and even takes on Gloucester, who was, becomes mm-hmm. Richard III
yeah.
in this particular feat.
Mm-hmm. And it's so, how do you play this, first of all? How do you enter? What are these asides? How do you work the crowd? Because it's so essential that you make some connection with the audience if you're going to, you know, try and make this vital to them. And I was reading about a production where Margaret came in and she was carrying a sack on her back the whole time. She was dressed in all black. She was saying these asides.
Literally baggage.
Literally baggage, exactly, literally baggage. But then eventually she takes the bag off, she opens it up, and there are two skeletons of her husband and her son, and she starts assembling them on the floor. And this kind of like ritual, and you get it, I think you get immediately the kind of, well, there's the loss. I mean, that's a choice, and I think it's certainly vivid, and it lays it in there. But now, and I think what I was going to say is, this is how a person becomes a great cursor, I'm sure, it seems. You know, you and it began at the end there, you know, when she was beginning to get into this butcher language, you know, butchers and villains. You you know, in this you have no children. That's there's another what is that? The Scottish play, when Macduff finds out what's happened to his kids. I think one of those incredibly telling lines is, you know, the young Malcolm's trying to get him. Come on, gotta revenge this. That's where you'll find solace in revenge. And then he says, he has no children. And so it's a pretty moving reminder. But so this last scene is now a taste of where we, one of the last ways we see Margaret, and how we'll see if we can get a sense of how we imagine her now. And as you hear this, I'm interested to know, as you listen, whether you close your eyes or whether you read along, how this works on your imaginary forces. If you begin to see a person, if it's less visual and it's more of a pure oral experience. But it's very interesting to me that we're such an oral culture and we're not used to hearing this kind of language. And in this is an awfully long soundbite, you know, to ever hear. So just if you have that in the back of your mind, this after hearing. No, sorry, as a visual culture.
As a visual culture.
How we, yes. Sorry, I may have, yeah. I must have misspoke that. What? Were you snarling all before I came? Ready to catch each other by the throat and turn you all your hatred now on me? Did York's dread curse prevail so much with heaven that Henry's death, my lovely Edward's death, their kingdom's loss, my woeful banishment, could all but answer for that peevish brat? Can curses pierce the clouds and enter heaven? Why then give way, dull clouds, to my quick curses? If not by war, by surfeit die your king, as ours by murder to make him a king. Edward, thy son, which now is Prince of Wales, for Edward, my son, which was Prince of Wales, die in his youth by like untimely violence. Thyself a queen, for me that was a queen, outlive thy glory like my wretched self. Long mayest thou live to wail thy children's loss, and see another, as I see now, decked in thy rights, as thou art stalled in mine. Long die thy happy days before thy and after many lengthened hours of grief, die neither mother, wife, nor England's queen. Rivers and Dorset, you were standers by, and so wast thou, Lord Hastings, when my son was stabbed with bloody daggers. God, I pray him,
that none of you may live your natural age, but by some unlooked accident cut off. But by some unlooked accident cut off. Have done!
Thou my charm, thou hateful withered hag!
And leave out thee? Stay, dog, for thou shalt hear me. If heaven have any grievous plague in store, exceeding those that I can wish upon thee, oh, let them keep it till thy sins be ripe, and then hurl down their indignation on thee, the troubler of the poor world's peace. The worm of conscience still benaw thy soul. Thy friends suspect for traitors while thou livest, and take deep traitors for thy dearest friends. No sleep close up that deadly eye of thine, unless it be whilst some tormenting dream affrights thee with a hell of ugly devils. Thou elvish marked abortive rooting hog. Thou that wast sealed in thy nativity, the slave of nature and the son of hell. Thou slander of thy mother's heavy womb. Thou loathed issue of thy father's loins. Thou rag of honor, thou detested. And at this point, Richard, Mark, Richard. And he interrupts. There's this great scene in which, or this exchange in which Richard interrupts him. Interrupts her, cutting her off. And I think in Shakespeare, the greatest violence you can perpetrate on someone is to silence them. Mm-hmm. You can kill them, but they'll probably get a great death speech. But if you silence them, that's the worst thing. That's the worst violence you can commit to someone. Any final thoughts before we finish up on any new impression of Margaret there? Did you feel vindicated at all by?
Exactly.
Are you still, are you any more on Margaret's side after that, or are you still unable to forgive the bloody napkin business? Because it's pretty awful.
I'm still feeling not quite so. I mean, she suffered. I mean, she's obviously very human, but she's still, suffering doesn't excuse you.
Mm.
Well,
suffering doesn't excuse you. Yeah, if
Well, there are different circumstances between Meg's and Rutland's death. I mean, was Rutland Boulder killed in battle? Or?
Actually, they were both killed essentially innocently. I mean, Edward was being taken away. Edward is Margaret's son. He was being taken, led away, and then they seized on him and killed him. And Rutland, I mean, he was a child. He was a Edward is beginning to do battle, but Rutland was, as it's usually played, a small child, and so it's considered it's an awful thing, but certainly they're being counterweighed against each other.
I think what strikes me about her character is just how miserable she is. She's tormented and sad and angry, and it feels as though there is violence that she's begetting and violence that she has been begotten, and that it has made her miserable.
She's almost channeling this vengeance.
She's
through her, calling it down on.
She's become like an oracle, or a mouthpiece. Yeah. In some ways, I do think she is in the midst of, this is a play. I see these plays have been set in a butcher shop, which I think is a kind of brilliant way to say, this whole series of plays, it all takes place in a butcher shop. And it's so perfect because there's blood everywhere, everybody's dying, and that's just the mentality. And her voice, I think, is the through line that is a kind of mouthpiece for the madness of war in a lot of ways. Great. We're at time, but thanks so much for engaging in that discussion with me.